Okay, so I feel like Baruch Shechianu v'kimanu. 4 months we did not learn together in person. It was really, 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 really weird. So yesterday, I told one of my kids that the Chabura is coming back. So this was the reaction. I said this to somebody. Ozzy was like, "Yes, I'm coming." I was like, "I'll RSVP for you." He goes, "What are they serving?" I'm like, "There's no food." He's like, "I don't know. I'm not ready to commit just yet." I was like, "All right." Then as I was leaving, he's like, "Wait, you're bringing cupcakes?" I was like, "Yeah." He goes, "Is there going to be anything else? Because if there is, please bring back." I was like, "Maybe a bottle of water." So, yeah. But one of my daughters, my 10-year-old, was so excited that we are going to have the opportunity to learn again. So she made cupcakes, so there are plates and there's everything. So at some point, hopefully, they'll get eaten. But
certain rules apply, like
there's a glove there. They're all whatever. Yeah, you could at 9:30. Anyhow, to me, it's really, really exciting to be back. First off, anybody that's in this room, I could see, right? Srili's not just a SF, right? It's like really, really, really wonderful. And I do think that as interactive as some weeks were on Zoom, there's a delay and I freeze and you freeze and whatever. So thank God, it is wonderful to be learning together once again. I want to share with you a piece by Rabbi Sacks tonight, but I also want to share with you beforehand what I'm doing with my summer. So somebody asked me, I think it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, a few months ago, they're like, "Well, you know, what are you going to do if there's no camp this summer?" And I was like, "Whatever, I'll find something to fill up my time with." And they're like, "All right, well, okay." So then I was like, "There's going to be camp, so it's not going to be an issue anyway." But there is no camp, and I'm home, and school is keeping plenty busy with how and what and if and whatever. But what I did decide my summer learning was going to be was I was going to try to learn Sefer Yeshaya. So those of you that know, over the last couple of years, I learned Yirmiyahu with the Navi guys, and that was really, really special. But I felt like I missed out on Yeshaya. So my plan, at least in mind, was we got 8 Haftorahs in a row from Yeshaya. We'll just knock it out that way. Every week will be the Haftorah. So I don't think that's going to be the case. But what I do find is I find that an appreciation of Yeshaya and what his Sefer represented is a pretty amazing thing to understand in its proper context, and to understand this week's Haftorah and all the subsequent Haftorahs that are, you know, going to be over the next couple of weeks. So I hope to share a little bit of that with you as well tonight. So let's start from the beginning. Eila hadvarim asher diber Moshe kol Yisrael. These are all the things that Moshe said to the Jewish people. Be'ever hayardein b'midbar b'arava mul suf bein parano bein tofel v'lavan v'chatzero v'dizahav. So these are all the things that Moshe said when he spoke to the Jewish people. Where is he? He's Be'ever Yarden, and he's at the final stop for the Jewish people before they cross over, and he's really basically at his final resting place. He's going to speak for the next 30 days, that's Sefer Dvarim, and when it's over, he's going to then pass on, and after that, the Jews will pass over the Jordan River. So the two questions I want to start with tonight are, what's the purpose of Sefer Dvarim? Right? Most people, and I actually, this is the first time in a really long time, that I actually won't miss a Chabura, I think, through Sefer Dvarim. But I personally have always been super excited that I hit about Parshas Pinchas, and I'm like, it's just 5 weeks to Bereishis, for me at least. And, you know, all the local people have to pick up the slack in the summer. But what's the purpose of Sefer Dvarim? That is the first question I want to try to understand tonight. And the second question is, and I think this is a really important one, is how does Moshe Rabbeinu become Moshe Rabbeinu? It's not a title he's ever given in the Torah. He's called Moshe. He's Moshe Eved Hashem. He's maybe Ish HaElokim. He's never Moshe Rabbeinu. Where does that come? So I'd like to suggest that Sefer Dvarim is where Moshe transitions. Until Sefer Dvarim, Moshe is the man of God. He's the person that takes him out of Egypt. He's the person that saves him. He's the person that does miracles. He's the person that yells at them. He's the person that occasionally has to punish them. That's what he does throughout Sefer Dvarim, throughout Shmos, Vayikra, and Bamidbar. And then all of a sudden we hit Sefer Dvarim, and what happens? Well, Moses doesn't do anything other than just talk for a really long time. So those are the two questions I want to try to figure out tonight. So this first pasuk, Moshe speaks be'ever yarding ba'arava, and then we're told mol suf, next to suf, between Paran and Tophel, v'lavan v'chatzerot v'dizahav. These are all these places. So the question is, where are these places that it's talking about? So the Ibn Ezra gives an answer and says these are places in the area. Now, you'll say the problem is that in last week's parsha in Maaseh, there is no indication of these places at all. We were told all the stops, and a lot of them are new. We haven't heard of any of them until Parshas Maaseh because they weren't important stops. But all of a sudden, we're introduced to these places, and nowhere there do we hear about Tophel, Lavan, Chatzerot, and Dizahab. But Ibn Ezra says they're places, and maybe what the Ibn Ezra's point is, they're not stops. But if you were to identify where the Jews are right now, they are in Arvos Moav. And what's near there? Arvos Moav is, I guess, the area of Moav right by the Jordan River. If you want to pinpoint it, so look for Paran, Tophel, Lavan, Chatzeros, and Dizahav. And when you find those places, then all of a sudden you're able to say, okay, I got it. That's where you'll find the Jewish location. And then he says, it goes back in time and says, I want to remind you, you were 11 days away from Israel when you got to Kadesh Barnea. And even at that, God made it quicker. God made an 11-day journey take 3 days. And then it goes back in time to say, okay, well, actually goes forward in time to say it's the 40th year of the 12th month, Be'achad Lachodesh. I'm sorry, I said before 30 days. I guess if it's the first day of Adar, so it's his last 7 days, I apologize. Diber Moshe ben Yisrael. Moshe speaks to the Jewish people. Kochal asher tzivahu to'aleihem. What God had put in his mouth to say. Achareach hakoto et Sichon melech Amori asher yoshev b'cheshbon. It's after he had defeated Sichon, the king of Amori, who was in Cheshbon. Og melech Abashan asher yoshev b'ashro pedrei. And also he had defeated Og, the king of Bashan, who was in a different place. Be'ever yardein be'eretz Moab. Ho'il Moshe be'eret ha-Torah zot le'mor. It was on the other side of the Jordan River, right? Not the side that we normally think about in the land of Israel, but rather it's the eastern side of the Jordan. Ho'il Moshe be'eret ha-Torah zot le'mor. Moshe began to translate, to explain the Torah. This, Rabbi Sacks says, is the source for how Moshe becomes Moshe Rabbeinu. Be'eret ha-Torah. He spends the end of his life explaining the entire Torah. He wants to know that before he dies, all the Jewish people will know the Torah, will understand the Torah, will get the Torah, and that's how we have, you know, the idea of the first Mishnah and Avos, Moshe Kibel Torah Mesinai, Umesar LeYoshua. This is the Mesorah that starts. It's passed from generation to generation. Moshe doesn't want to die until he knows that it's passed on. So the question is, what makes Moshe a great teacher? Is it just that he taught well, or is there more to that than simply being a good teacher, right? And that's, I think, a good question. Just in general, what makes a good teacher? Is a good teacher a person that is just able to convey information in a clear way, or is there more to be expected from a teacher? And I think that will kind of help us unpack a little bit who Moshe is. All right, so those were our five psukim for tonight. Any questions?
Why so detailed the location? Why are they so
good? So according to the Ibn Ezra, it's a very tough one to understand. Like, who cares? Do you plan on going there and saying, like, all right, I need to find where ancient Tophel, Lavan, Chatzero, and Dizahav are, so I could, like, really pinpoint the place, and then maybe once I find that, I could look for, you know, signs or, you know, anything, any indications that the Jews are there. Who cares, right? So the Ibn Ezra, I think, is very tough with that one. We're going to take a look at Rashi in a little bit. Rashi will point out that these are not real places. This is all made up. Well, not made up in the sense that
reference to Musar.
That, right. It's all Musar of what happened. Is that a thought?
There wasn't, but it didn't make a lot of sense, right? When you want to teach your kids something, what do you do? And remember, they went in a big circle. So
right.
They're back to where they started.
No.
No?
No. They ended up in, like, southern Israel. Right, that's where when they sent the Meraglim 38 years earlier, southern Israel probably, I don't know, somewhere in the southern part of the Negev, right? And then that's how they were going to go into the land of Israel, like straight up that way. God says, all right, you messed up, so now what happens? They have to go like a circuitous way for 38 years. And when it's over, rather than going straight up that way, so they go past Edom, Ammon, Moab, right, by like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and then they push their way up until they conquer Sihon and Og, and then they're directly across the Jordan River by, across from Jericho. So they're not they're not in the same spot.
They're on the Jordan side.
Correct. Okay. Any yeah.
Yeah, why do you need the first half to pay? You already said it in all.
That's good question. No idea. Okay, so let's take a look at Rashi. So Rashi says, Eila ha-dvarim, lefi shehein divrei tochachos. Like David said, this is not... Everything at the beginning of Dvarim is tochacha. It's Moser. Moshe Rabbeinu wants to say to them, listen... Do you know how different it all could have been? Imagine what would have happened if we had played our cards differently. Like, this didn't have to be what it ended up. So what happens? He mentions all the places that they angered God. Therefore, but he doesn't want to say the names outright. So he hints at it. Kind of, I guess, like, you know, when you... Sometimes when we discipline our children, it's very direct. That, like, we tell them exactly what went wrong, what they did, etc. And sometimes it's not so much that way. Sometimes it's more like you say something and, like, they hear what you're saying, even though you're not addressing it directly, and they're like, yeah, I get it. So Rashi says that's exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu was doing. He wanted to say it, but not outright. Nikvod dan shel Yisrael, because of he had respect and the dignity of the Jews. El kol Yisrael, ilu hochiach mitzatam. Why did it have to be all the Jews? Because if he had only said it to some of them, ayu elu shebashuk omrim, you would have had the people that were out in the shuk. They would say, atem ha'itim shomim ben amram velo heshivotem davar mikach v'kach. You heard it from Moshe. This is what Moshe said to you. You didn't respond. Right? Why? Ilu hayinu sham. If we were there, hayinu meshivin oto. We would have responded, and this is what we would have said. L'kach kintan kulam v'amar lahem harei kulchem kan. Moshe Rabbeinu says them. It's amazing. He, according to Rashi, he opens up his speech and says, Eila dvarim. I'm opening it up. Okay, I'm going to speak, and if anybody has anything that they want to comment... Now's the time to speak up or forever hold your peace. What's amazing is nobody says anything. Right? Can you imagine 3 million people at a speech and the speaker says, I'm open. Tell me what I'm saying that's wrong. And the people are speechless. Right? That's pretty amazing. So that's what Moshe says. Bamidbar. So Rashi now starts off and says, Bamidbar. Lo bamidbar hayu elabar v'moav. Rashi says, they weren't in the desert, they were Ba'arvot Moav. Midbar was Midbar Sinai, Midbar Tzin. Umau Ba'midbar, Ela Bishvil Mashi Chisu Ba'midbar. It's because how they angered God when they were in the desert. Shamru, like they said, Mi Yitain Mutenu. When they said, right, who will give us meat, we're going to die, or who will give us food, we're going to die. Ba'arava. Bishvil ha'arava. When he says ba'arava, he's talking about what we know. That was their last sin. Shechatu b'bal pe'or b'shitim b'arvos moav. In arvos moav, that's when they sinned with the women and bal pe'or, where they defecated in front of the idols. Molsuf, al-mashehimru b'yamsuf b'voam li'yamsuf. When they messed up by yamsuf, By Yamsuf, they said, Hamibliyin Kvarim Mitzrayim. This is right when they left Egypt. And they say, oh, God, why did you take us out? Weren't there enough dead in Egypt? Why do we need another one? V'chein v'nasami tocha yam. And then when they left Yamsuf, Shenemar v'yamru al yam b'yamsuf. They complained v'yamsuf. K'di'ita be'erichin. Like the Gemara in Erichin details. So Rashi basically is saying that every place, this is not, you will not, these are very bad directions. If you want to try to find where the Jews were, because Bamidbar was when they complained about not having food. Barava is right here. Mol Suf is going back to Yam Suf. So it's in no way talking about a, you know, pinpointing a place. Vein Paran uvein Tofel. Amar Yochanan Chazarno kol mikra. Yochanan says, I looked through the entire Torah, but lomatzinu makom sheshmo tofel of the lavan. You're not going to find anywhere anything called tofel or lavan. Elahu chichan al dvarim shetoflu alaman shehu lavan. What is being tofel or being lavan? About tofel and lavan, which was when they complained about things, shetoflu alaman. They made the man, they made light of the man, which is lavan, which is white, shenem v'amru, Nafshenu katsa b'lechem aklokel. Like when they said, right, we are, our souls are disgusted b'lechem haklokel, with this horrible bread. B'masha su b'midbar paran ayideh miraglim. And then the last one is midbar paran is the miraglim, chayta miraglim. B'chatzei wrote b'machlekuto shel korach. That's the machlokus of korach. B'aver acher amar lehem Hayalachem lomo b'masha siti l'miriam b'chatzeiros b'shalashin hara v'atem nidbartem b'makom. He says, you should have learned. An alternative explanation is, you should have learned what the effects of Lashon Hara are from Miriam. Miriam was in Chatzeiros, she spoke Lashon Hara, and she got punished, and yet you spoke Lashon Hara about God. Okay. So far, every one of these places is clearly, he's looking at the Jewish people and saying, you messed up. Right? You complained about the food, you complained about the location, you complained about the accommodations, you spoke badly about God, you complained about me. Everything is on the Jewish people. And then we get to the last one. V'di zahav. Ochichan ala egel, shasu b'shul rov ha-zahav shayalahem. So he gives them tochacha, ochichan. But he points at the Jews and says, you guys messed up on the Egel because you had too much gold. Shinemar v'kesef yirbeitila v'zahava sulabal. As the Pasuk says, you had too much money and the gold that you had, you made into idols. This is not a Pasuk from Chumash. It's a Pasuk somewhere from Nevi'im or Ksuvim. Okay. So Rashi says, Di Zahav. What's Di Zahav? It's Egel HaZahav. Egel HaZahav. What is he telling them that they did wrong? Meaning everyone was what they did wrong. What did they do wrong by Egel? They had too much gold. Now, he doesn't say what you did wrong by the Egel was you made the Egel. He said, well, I mean, Hochichan al Egel, obviously, but his point is, that not that you made the Egel, but you made the Egel because you had too much gold.
That's not their fault.
Right.
What are they supposed to do? The gold is washing up on the shore. They just leave it there?
But God told them to take what they could out of them. That's right.
Right.
So the problem is that Rashi points out, on the one hand, he says, listen, this is clear tofacha. They messed up. But if you were writing Rashi, how would you write it? Right, hochichan ala egel she'asu, period. Now, if you want to say that there was that you used it for the wrong purpose, period, and then somehow, I'm not even going to try to say it in Lashon Rashi, but then the second point that Rashi should say is, and you should have used all of that gold l'shem shamayim. And yet he doesn't say that. He says that your mistake was you made the egel, and it's quite, and the reason for that is because you had too much gold. So it seems
And what would they have spent the gold on before the Eagle? There was no Mishkan. There were no real carbonos. There was no
gold
to spend the money on.
I'm not even saying that you need to do that. Meaning, what you could say is, just say that it's you did the Eagle. Now, Rashi is bothered not by the fact that the place is called Zahav, but it's called D-Zahav. D for the word die, right? So he said, why is that? It doesn't make any sense. So Rashi's trying to darshan it. The problem is you get yourself into a little bit of trouble because it doesn't seem like the Rashi's second point, B'shul Rova Zahav Shahaya Lahem, doesn't seem to be their fault. It seems to be God's fault. And so the question then becomes, why is it that Moshe A concludes, it's not certainly Egel HaZahav is not their last Aveira, it's towards the beginning. Why does he conclude with that, number one? And number two, why is it that Rashi comments the way he does? So that's really what I want to try to understand. And I believe that if we understand that, we will have a much better understanding of A, the purpose of Sefer Bamidbar, B, I'm sorry, Sefer Dvarim, thank you. B, right, the transition to Moshe Rabbeinu, and then what is the quality of a teacher that makes Moshe Rabbeinu such a unique and special teacher? So I want to share with you the Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara in Brachos, which Rashi quotes somewhere, but not on this page, Rashi quotes the final Gemara in Brachos. He says that Moshe defends the Jewish people and says, it's not fair, God. You totally set them up. Cheta Egel is not their fault. Okay, so what's his defense? So Moshe Rabbeinu says, listen, God, if you take a 17-year-old boy, an 18-year-old boy, and you give him a lot of money, with a purse around his neck full of money, and then you put him in the red light district of wherever, and he's left on his own, and all these women see him with the money, what's going to happen? I mean, come on, God, right? Like, you can't blame the kid. He's a 17-year-old, 18-year-old idiot. All these women come to him and say, oh, I've been waiting for you all my life. He doesn't know better. He gives him the gold, and he messes up. And he says, God, that's what you did. You gave the Jews, they were slaves. They didn't have a penny to their name for years and years. And now all of a sudden, they've got all this money. They don't know what to do with it. And then they have this moment of fright and they're like, we got to do something about this. So they spend it on idolatry. Again, it's not a perfect example. But again, in one case, there's a cause and effect. If you put a person in a certain situation, they are likely to end up doing something that you don't want them to do. That's what the Gemara says. Josh, you look like you have something to say. No. For the last, 4 months,
I don't know what he looks like.
I mean, I know we're focusing on the gold part of the ego. Why not focus on the other, the front and the back end? They killed four, and then they had a party afterwards. It wasn't just that they made the ego. It was this celebration after the Eagle. And that was in those two events by themselves are probably almost worse than in your scenario of the 17-year-old kid. That's the Eagle, the party before and killing the party after and killing Khor.
Well, because Moshe's looking to defend them. How would he defend them on that? No, but the Gemara's point, one second, Rami, the Gemara's point is specifically that Moshe Rabbeinu came and said, I need to find a way of saying, Moshe, the Jewish people did not mess up. It's a hard one, but that's what he's going for. Yeah.
Just to bring this back, Elohad Dvarim is talking about the locations where Hashem got angry at Bnei Yisrael.
Right.
So these are just references that these locations is where Hashem got angry. It's not Moshe's using it as a reference, and Rashi's explaining what the references are and how Hashem got angry. So it's the location Zahav is what was Zahav. That's where they made the golden calf. Hashem got angry and everyone got angry.
Right. No. So that all of that makes sense. the problem is that Rashi's comment, there's something that just doesn't seem... Like all the other ones, he explains, they did X wrong. Here he says they did something wrong.
He's explaining the name. How is the name related to the location?
But wouldn't the name be okay? Zahav. It's the connection to the gold. So you're going to say it's the D part, right? I guess the D from Dai, they had enough gold because if they had had less, then they wouldn't. But again, it's a little bit.
The Amish there is, you're going to accuse a Kaddish Baruch Hu of lifting the Eden, right? Which is what it sounds like the Gemara is doing, right? Then why go to the gold? Go with the. You got Moshe here. You're looking down over there, Kibiyachol. You see what's going on. You could have sent Moshe back. Before all this, you could have sent a sign. You sent other signs before all this.
Okay.
If they're questioning everything in Aaron HaKohen Davins, where's the, why the gold? In other words, of all the things to pick on.
Well,
I think the analogy is, it's almost like up until then, to the point, up until then, they had nothing. Even though they had all this gold, they still had nothing. They needed the Ribbono Shel Olam in order to survive everything. They come to a place, there's no water. Can you buy water? No. You need a Kaddish Baruch Hu. All the things that he did for them, they were things they couldn't buy.
Okay.
This is the first thing that happens where they feel like they're buying something.
So you're saying it's a lack of gratitude. That they don't recognize God.
I think that's A, how you explain why the Gemara is going up down for the gold. But if you think about what's different from this versus all the other things, what's different is this is the first time that they had an ability to buy something for them, to do something, at least in their own minds, to do something for themselves.
Okay, so that you're saying that's why Rashi adds in Bishvil Rov Hazav. Okay, could be. So Moshe, according to the Gemara, Moshe's defense of the Bnei Yisrael is what it is. So the question is, what's the role of a leader? And this is what Rabbi Sacks says, and it's so beautiful. He says, the role of a leader is more than just being a good speaker, and it's even more than being a good teacher. Although those are all important qualities, but the role of a good leader and a good teacher is a person that defends his students and that defends his congregation. And specifically, he defends the ones that are the hardest to defend. You know, sometimes people will ask you when you're a teacher, like, you know, about this kid and that kid. There are some kids that are just easy to like, right? Like, they're the kids that sit in the back and they do or in the front, and they do everything that you ask them to do. Now, those kids in the pre-Zoom world were like superstars. And then you had the kid that couldn't sit, and the kid that, like, served the whole class. And in the world before Zoom, those kids were like really like ate at the teacher's kishkas. Zoom was an amazing thing because you shut their video and you muted them and you're like, I love that kid. He's just a pair of initials. He's awesome. He never misbehaves, right? But there is some truth to that. But that said, to be able to defend the kid that's so hard to defend, that's the mark of a great teacher. And I mean, I've seen it myself where you're at a meeting and there's a teacher who sits there and says, no, this kid's amazing. And you sit there, you're like, really? Like, look at all the things this kid, it's a good kid, in his heart. Or, I've seen this, I've seen that. That's the role, says Rabbi Sacks, of a teacher. How does Moshe Rabbeinu do that? Moshe Rabbeinu says, not like Rashi, but V'di Zahav, like the Gemara in Brachos, what is he saying? He's saying, God, this is on you. This is not my fault. This is not the Jewish people's fault. This is not Aaron's fault. But in retrospect, 38 years later, he changes the narrative. And he says, it's not the Jewish people's fault, God, but it's your fault. You set them up.
Why listed here?
Why listed here?
Yeah, so, every other one on the list was the Jews' fault. Why is this one on the list if it's not the Jew's fault?
So
it is the Jew's fault.
No, he's just playing.
Right, so I would argue,
I guess,
I think what Rabbi Sacks will say is that at the very end, Moshe's I think this is what he would say. The last point that he makes is he's trying to defend the Jewish people and saying, yes, 40 years in the desert, they messed up time and time and time again. But understand, God, that it's my role as the teacher. Before Be'er Moshe, Be'er the Torah Zot, before I explain the entire Torah, I'm going to give them Tochacha. But I want you, God, to know that it's not that it's my job to try to find the silver lining in
so
the situation.
Why do you do that? I think I know your answer. But, you know, this parsha is always read the week before Tisha, right? So a couple of months ago, we read about
okay.
And he admits, this is us. We did this. We were bad, but please. He does tshuva, and he figures out the formula for tshuva. Tshuva to Nechem to come around, never gets right the tshuva process. And the tshuva process is not to say that it's your fault, that you did this to me, that you caused it. It's to say, it was me. I'm the problem, and I know that I have. So how do we, like, you got these two bookends. You got, like,
yeah.
It almost sounds like the teacher who the students all fail, and then he goes to administration and says, the curriculum you gave me was bad. It's really like that. What Josh is saying is, you're resetting the whole formula instead of saying, yeah, it failed, but we all thought that it was our fault, but it was your fault.
Okay, that's fair, yeah.
I have another problem is, who's he telling this to? Not one person who was there.
Right. It's the next generation. But
that's a good answer. That's a good answer.
Oh, so it's not your fault.
It's not your grandparents. That's a really good answer.
I hear. Yes.
Your parents and your grandparents, you know, that's not on you, but we still have to live with that.
I like that.
I like that.
So I actually
want. We punish the children for the father's mistake.
Well, they know.
Hang on. Pokeh avot albanim be'albanim banim. Pokeh avot avot.
So it's interesting, Josh. I thought you were going to go a little bit differently on your point, but I will share. It's actually the minhag that we read, the Kriyas HaTorah for Tisha B'Av morning is what?
Baschana.
And if you read that really carefully, it's not a terribly depressing laning. In fact, there's some hope in it, right? Why do we read that on Tisha B'Av morning? So do you know what that wasn't always the case. They even know what they used to read on Tisha B'Av morning? I mean, I only feel smart because I learned this last Shabbos when I was looking for a chabura, but otherwise. No, so that, I guess they did that at Mincha. I don't know if that ever was. They used to read Parshas HaMiraglim on Tisha B'Av morning, which makes perfect sense, right? So Rabbi Riskin says, why did we change it? Because it doesn't make any sense. And then he says, so another great question. He goes, like we talk about, Shabbos Chazon. Right? It's such a sad Shabbos. Why? Chazon Yeshaya ben Amos. You want to really pick a good Haftorah? Don't read from Yeshaya. Where should you read from?
Jeremiah.
Yeah, I mean, like, Yirmiyahu became like his name. A Jeremiah ad is a depressing, like, Pomer story. Like, he is the paradigm of, like, horrible stuff. Why do we pick from Yeshaya? So Rabbi Riskin says, and maybe this is, you know, a little bit to answer your point, is that you can beat people up. And that's what happened in Chet HaMeraglim. But when you look at it from the perspective of, like, time later on, sometimes we have to, like, pick the people up and say, like, okay, there's hope. Because if you go back and do Chet HaMeraglim a second time, you're like, you see how bad it was? I want you to read it 38 years later because it hasn't gotten any better. Then what ends up happening is, and all these other Averos, the people are like, all right, well, then what's the point? Like, why are we doing this? So it could be that that's part of the reason why Moshe Rabbeinu rewrites the story a little bit and does control the narrative a little bit and veers it in a more positive and hopeful direction. Say again?
He's their buying, too.
Right, yeah.
Especially because he's about to beg of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to forgive him and let him in.
Correct. Okay, so now let's take a look at the Haftorah. Chazon Yeshayahu ben Amos. I said this to someone recently because somebody was asking me why I'm learning Yeshaya and, you know, did I ever learn Yeshaya before? So I said I actually did learn Yeshaya. I went to MTA a while ago. And when I was an MTA, so Rabbi Suna, Alav Shalom, who was no youngster when I was there, so if people are slightly older or a lot older, they might have had him in MTA also. So Rabbi Suna taught me Navi in, I believe, 9th and 10th grade. And he taught Yeshaya in, I believe, 9th grade. And what I could tell you is the only thing I remember from 9th grade was he sang Perek Hei to a tune that wasn't really so much of a tune. It was more of like a dirge. And he sang that in the tune that he had learned in the ghetto before he had gone to the concentration camp. So just to give you a perspective, he was no youngster when I met him in the 90s. So... What?
He did this once or several times.
What?
Sing it.
Just that one. That
one. It was one dirge in ninth grade.
Yes, it was. It was Kerem Hayali di di Bekerem. It was just like a singing, depressing. It sounded like.
I'm gonna forget that.
but he did it. It was the whole period. Went through the whole half tour. That's all I remember.
You're not putting that into your repertoire.
Oh, no.
So I'll tell you what the problem is. The problem is, and I think that this is really where most people mess up when they teach Nevi'im Achronim, is that if you teach Nevi'im Achronim in a bubble, in a vacuum, it makes no sense. Like I said to someone, this very first pasuk of Yeshaya should probably take a good few days to teach. And yet, I think it sounded like this. Okay, there was this guy Yeshaya. He was a Navi in Yehuda, in Yerushalayim, in the days of these kings. Viter. You know what the problem with that is? The average ninth grade boy has never gotten far enough in Navi to know who Uzziahu, Yotam, Achaz, or Chizkiyahu were. So you read that pasuk and you're like, yeah, it's great. And then it's not even going to be a question in the test because, like, who cares? But what we need to know about Yeshaya was that Yeshaya lived at a time that was so different than Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu lived at the very end of Bayit Rishon in the times of highlight Yoshiyahu, and the low light with some of the low life kings that would end off Melachim Bet. Yeshaya lived in a years earlier, at the time when the southern kingdom was at its heyday and the northern kingdom was at its end. When it looked like there was no hope for the northern kingdom, and possibly the northern kingdom would also, when they got knocked out, the southern kingdom would be knocked out also, and yet they emerged victorious. So Yeshaya lives in a time where when he dies at the end of his life, Chizkiyahu Melech was the king. And things do seem somewhat hopeful that there's the potential for the Jewish people to be successful. And yet when he starts, and unlike Yirmiyahu, which is all over the place and chronologically is totally like scattered, you can start in a perek and then go to the next perek and you've gone 20 years back, and then you go to the next perek and you've gone 15 years forward. Yeshaya seems to be relatively chronologically accurate. So his first nevuah takes place in the times of Uzziahu. So there are some people that should know a little bit about Uzziahu, because there's a famous song, I think, by the Diaspora Yeshiva band, right? Vayiven Uzziahu Migdalim Birushalayim. Yeah, what happened? So what happened was that Uzziahu took over as king, and the northern kingdom was like powerful, southern kingdom not so much. And the southern kingdom, the Malchus Yehuda, what he does is he invests in infrastructure, right? It sounds a little bit like make Judah great again. Right? That was what he was trying to do. He built and built and built and built. Even Uzziahu Migdalim, and he fortifies it. The Jewish people are actually, it's impressive. And the economics of the southern kingdom are amazing. And everybody is living a prosperous, well, not everybody, many people are living a prosperous life.
You know what you just proved? The fact that we know that song, even though I have no idea where it came from, if you really want your message to resonate with us longer, you got to start singing it.
That's Rabbi Suna. One pasuk he sang in whole in 2 years. It's true. I mean, right. Like, there are famous psukim that Avram Fried and other singers take that, like, you're like, really? Like, that's a pasuk. I actually, when Mordechai Shapiro
very
was...
funny parody about this.
When Mordechai Shapiro was still our music teacher in Hank, I was in the middle of somewhere in Yirmiyahu, and I came to him. I was like, Mordechai, I'm telling you. I was like, this pasuk needs to be a song. I was like, it needs to be a song, not because you need to sell albums and have concerts and stuff like that. It's like, it needs to be a song because people need to know it.
It's like
and it's still not, by the way. But, alright, I tried.
It's like Koto Dito Fink from Simple Liner. I have no idea where that was.
Okay, so, I'll be honest, Koto Dito Fink is more famous than a lot of these other psukim, but Kol Dodiv Ofek is from Shir HaShirim. Rav Soloveitchik certainly did a good job of making it famous with his famous article, which is worth reading, called Kol Dodiv Ofek. But because it's in the story of Shir HaShirim, where it's like the woman is not, you know, the guy is knocking on the door, like, whatever. But yeah, it's true. Your point is a good one. We know certain psukim because musicians have made them famous. Sadly, they don't take the psukim always that we need to know. But okay, Yeshaya, what happens? He comes along in a time where everybody's affluent. And this is what he says. Shimu shamayim vazini aretz, ki Hashem diber, banim gidalti, veromamti vein pashubi. He says, look what happened. My children have grown up, and they sinned against me. Yadashur konehu, right? The cow knows his owner. And the donkey knows who feeds it. And yet, Yisrael lo yada, ani lo hitbonan. The Jewish people don't know me. Their nation doesn't think about me. Hoy goy chote. They're a nation of sinners. Am kevet avon. Zera mireim banim ashritim azu et Hashem. They forsook God. Niyatsu katoshi Yisrael nazor achor. And they turn their backs to God. Al netuku od tosifu sarah kol rosh l'chali v'chol lev davai. All right, it's bad stuff. Mikav regel, and they're going to be punished. Mikav regel v'ad rosh ein bo metom petza v'chabura maket shriya lo zoru v'lechubashu v'leruch chobashemen. I will punish them, I will beat them up, and nothing will save them. Arzichem shmama, areichem srufos eish. Their cities, their land will be destroyed and desolate, their cities burned by fire. It will be destroyed and flipped over. And Bat Zion will be left by itself, like the sukkah out in the vineyard, all by itself. And why is this? It's because we were like stone. We were like Amora. What was so bad about Sodom and Amora? The truth is that the cities of Sodom and Amora, they might not have, they probably didn't worship idols. And if they did, God doesn't really care about them. What did the people in Sodom and Amora do? It was a city of people that were very, very wealthy. Very wealthy. And they had everything they needed. And the only thing they said is, we want to live in a bubble, and we only want wealthy people to live with us. God forbid a poor person should come into our town. It's going to ruin our property value. That's what they say. Why is Yeshaya using the comparison to Sodom and Amorah? Because Yeshaya is going to spend 5 prakim at the beginning of Yeshaya writing about what? Prophesizing about what? And prophesizing to who? He's not talking to everyone, but he's talking to the wealthy and saying, how could you be living in this world and not notice as you walk in the street the poor people that are there? He talks to the women who are wearing the finest of clothing and probably holding those shopping bags in their arms like that with their noses up in the air, and not realizing that despite the fact that they look great, what about all the poor people around them? That's Yeshaya's message. So now I want to fast forward. I don't have the psukim here, because when I made the Makoros, I couldn't find what perek it was. But perek vav. Perek vav of Yeshaya, you know what he does there? God tells him, I'm done with the Jewish people. I have no interest in them anymore. But this is what I want you to do, he says to Yeshaya. I want you to fatten them up. So this way, when they get slaughtered, it'll be an even bigger, massacre. That's what God says to Yeshaya. Now, if God had said that to Yirmiyahu, I don't know if the response would have been the same. Because Yirmiyahu very rarely goes out on a limb and says, God, how could you do that to the Jews? But rather what Yirmiyahu does is, he tells the Jews, this is what God's going to do. And when the Jews mess up, what does Yirmiyahu do? I told you. Yeshaya breaks down and says, God, this can't be. How could you do that? I refuse. I won't give that message to the Jewish people. God, you have to have mercy on the Jewish people. Says Rabbi Sacks and Rabbi Lau separately, but I think it's such a perfect tie-in. The greatness of Moshe, he's Moshe Rabbeinu. And I think the greatness of Yeshaya, and Yeshaya is the ultimate poet, and as a Navi, the things he writes are so powerful and so beautiful. What's so amazing about both of them is that they have the ability to sit there and say, God, I know that the Jewish people don't deserve better. But Vidi Zahav, God, you have to look at it. It's not fully their fault. Cut them some slack. God, I can't deliver and say that the Jewish people should be destroyed. I don't have the heart to do that. That, says Rabbi Sacks, is what Moshe does and what makes Moshe so great. And that's what Yeshaya does, and that's what makes him so great. But I want to end with two other sources. The Gemara in Baba Basra says that miyom shechar beis hamikdash din hu shenigzor al atzmeinu shalachol basar v'loshtot yayin. From the times that the beis hamikdash was destroyed, we were supposed to be living permanently in the 9 days, no seal. What was it supposed to be? No meat, no wine. So the truth is, you can't impose something that people can't handle. From the time that Rome held the Jewish people, where they were mevatel the Torah, and they imposed all these gzeros ros on us. They wouldn't let us do the shua of the sun. We should have stopped getting married, and we should have stopped having children. And we should have just put an end to the Jewish people. Rabbi Sacks says this is how close the Jewish people were right after the Churban Bayit Sheni to giving it all up. They said, what's the purpose? What's the point? Why should we continue? So what was the response of the rabbis of their time? So take a look at the next Gemara. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Afilu Rekonim Shebach, some rabbi gave this drasha and said, even the worst of the Jews, Malayan mitzvos karimon, has mitzvos stuffed inside him like the seeds of a pomegranate. Meaning the worst of the Jews is still infinitely better than the best of the non-Jews. Why did the rabbis do this? Because the rabbis understood that if you wanted to have the Jewish people continue, you needed to change the narrative. If the narrative was tochacha, and even Rashi's way of writing it, hochichan, to chastise the Jewish people, ala egel, then eventually the Jewish people would say, what's the point? I can't do this. There's no hope. So the Gemara turns the table. Moshe turns the table. The rabbis that were giving drushos had to change, turn the table to infuse hope within the Jewish people, to say that there was hope for better days tomorrow. I'll end with a great story. I love it because Rabbi Sachs writes, it's a famous story of Rav Levi Yitzchak Miberdichev, and he says it might be apocryphal. It's like when Rav Soloveitchik tells Hasidish stories. He'll be like, "This story is a Hasidish story. I don't know if it happened." And then he'll tell another story, and he'll be like, "It's the story of Rav Chaim, my grandfather. It did happen. This story is real." So how does the story go? The story goes that there was a chassid, or not a chassid, there was a Jewish guy who did some pretty bad things. He ate on Yom Kippur, he was smoking in public, he's walking in the street. And so, Rav Levi Yitzchak Miberdichev walks over to him and says, "Nu, Reb Yid, don't you know it's Yom Kippur? You're not allowed to do this." He says, "Yeah, I knew it's Yom Kippur." He goes, "Oh, I get it, I get it. You knew it was Yom Kippur, but you didn't know that it was forbidden to smoke and to eat today." And he says, "No, I knew that also." So Levi Yitzchak Miberdichev stops. He points his hands up to the sky. He says, "God, do you see that? The Jewish people are so holy that they can't even tell a lie." The point of the story is, that's what Jewish leaders have to do. Jewish leaders have to look at the Jewish people, and yes, they do have to tell them off. And Moshe Rabbeinu does it. Eile ha-divarim. He goes through all these averos that they do. Like Rashi says, these places don't exist. They're all hochichan. He did give them tochach on everything they did wrong. But if it were to end there, he would never become Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu became Moshe Rabbeinu when he pivoted and became better than just a good speaker, which despite his humble beginnings he became. And better than becoming a good teacher, he became a melamed zchus for Klal Yisrael. The greatest of teachers will find a way to defend and protect those that are the hardest to defend and protect. And when they do that, they give these students, they give their children hope that there could be a better tomorrow for them. That's so critical, because that's what Moshe does. Moshe closes the book on his leadership by saying, "I never gave up on you, and there always is hope for you." And he transmitted that to countless leaders that would come after him, and he transmits that to each and every one of us to this very day. That's our job. Our job is to look and try to figure out, how can I be melamed zchus for my talmidim, whoever they are? How could I be melamed zchus for my children when they really need it sometimes? That's the message. And when that happens, Moshe Rabbeinu was elevated in a way that he could never have reached through the end of Sefer Bamidbar. And perhaps that's the purpose of Sefer Devarim. Moshe cements and seals his legacy and creates a legacy that is so much more powerful than his miracles, because we tell his miracles a couple times a year, but we learn his teachings and we try to practice those every single day.